You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, joined today by Prashant Parameswaran, as usual. Hi, Prashant. Thanks for joining me today.
Good to be with you, Ankit.
Yeah, so Prashant, it's a busy time in Asia with a great deal of summitry about to get underway with the G20 in China and the ASEAN Leaders Summit in Laos. We previewed both of those summits on the previous episode of this podcast, and hopefully, depending on the outcomes, we'll be able to follow up on those as well. And meanwhile, in Central Asia, it appears that we've just received confirmation that Uzbek President Islam Karimov succumbed to his latest stroke, so I'm hoping we'll be able to get to that in a future episode. But for this episode, at least, Prashant, I want to come back to a theme that we've addressed repeatedly in our podcast on Asian geopolitics, which is a theme that's really grown more prominent in the past 2 years, or it's at least accelerated, which is the strategic convergence between the United States and India, which has really been going on in some form or another since 2000, but really, it's been sort of one of those relationships that's full of unfulfilled promises in some ways, and unfulfilled promise. I think that's a perception that's both common in Washington and New Delhi for those who'd like to see the two countries come together. But I think this is a good week to talk about the U.S.-India relationship because we've just seen a lot of high-level communication between both sides. So Indian Defense Minister Manohar Parrikar just met Ash Carter, the U.S. Defense Secretary in Washington. And there were a few important accomplishments on that front that I'll talk about. But also, meanwhile, in New Delhi, Penny Pritzker and John Kerry met their Indian counterparts as well for the strategic and commercial dialogue, the second iteration of that agreement, of that dialogue. So there's a lot going on here. And we also saw, you know, Prime Minister Narendra Modi visit the United States earlier this summer. And I don't believe we directly addressed that on the podcast at the time. I think we're a little bogged down with the South China Sea, understandably. So we can talk about, you know, some of these themes that have come up. So Prashant, I guess I'll just start us off by talking about kind of the big deliverable that's been getting a lot of play in certainly the Indian press, but also here in the United States, which is the signing, the long-awaited signing of a logistics cooperation agreement between the United States and India, specifically on sharing military logistics on a reciprocal at-will basis. The agreement is called the Logistics Exchange Memorandum of Agreement. We'll call it LMOA for short, since we'll be saying that quite a bit on this podcast. And really, this has been something that was first mooted in the early 2000s, I believe 2003. So it's really been a long time coming, which kind of goes back to my point about, you know, the U.S.-India relationship being full of a lot of unfulfilled potential. So this was essentially a highly controversial thing in India. We can get into the domestic debate in a bit, but I do want to talk about what this is. And it's been getting a little bit overplayed, I think. LMOA, at the end of the day, I think is actually a fairly mundane agreement. The United States has similar agreements that are called Acquisition and Cross-Servicing Agreements, ASCAs, ACSAs, with, I think, about 75 countries, if I'm correct. I was trying to find a full list, couldn't find one exactly. But I think there's, you know, scores of countries that the United States, as, you know, the global hegemon with a navy that traverses all of the world seas, it has these agreements all across the world. So from the U.S. perspective, concluding this agreement with India is not really a game changer. And Carter and Parrikar were both very clear during their press conference in D.C., both aware of the debate in India, said that this is definitely not a basing agreement. India is not turning to Japan. It's not turning into a U.S. ally. It won't be hosting U.S. soldiers on U.S. soil on a permanent basis. Instead, what this is doing is it's simply greasing the wheels on the bureaucracy that already enables cooperation between the United States and India. I was sort of thinking of an analogy that might be a good way to, you know, explain what LMOA is. It's sort of, you know, you have two friends, you go out to eat. Often, you know, you're paying your friend back if he picks up the check. Essentially, what LMOA does, in my view, is essentially you're setting up, you know, some sort of spreadsheet to just keep track of everything, or, you know, just friending each other on Venmo or PayPal, however you want to put it, just to make that a little bit easier. That's essentially the crux of the argument. I don't want to oversimplify it. It does, you know, enable a wide range of cooperation. There's also possibilities for both the United States and India to refuse certain kinds of cooperation. Certainly that was something the Indians wanted baked into the agreement to prevent being drawn into U.S. imperial overreach, which I believe is a term a lot of Indians opposed to the agreement have used. You know, certain things like the Iraq War, India would have preferred to stay away from. In fact, there was a big debate in the country at the time. So that's a brief rundown of LMOA, Prashant. But, you know, you're a close observer of certainly in Washington, of, you know, the U.S. efforts to create a principled security network across the Asia Pacific. And to this end, India has increasingly been growing more and more important. How do you see LMOA sort of factoring into that broader plan that the United States seems to have for its partners and allies in the Asia Pacific.
Yeah, so I think you did a good overview of the significance of Lamoa within the broader U.S.-India relationship. So the U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter is famous for speaking about the U.S.-India defense relationship in terms of, and the U.S.-India relationship more broadly in terms of two handshakes. The first is, you know, sort of a strategic handshake where you have the interaction between the U.S. rebalance to the Asia-Pacific and India's initially look east but now act east policy under Narendra Modi. And the second handshake is the more sort of technological handshake where you have the initiatives like the Defense Trade and Technology Initiative, the DTTI, that Carter himself championed. And the U.S. and India are trying to move forward in very meaningful ways to actually get this strategic convergence operationalized and concretized. And in order to do that, you need these foundational agreements for some of these things to happen. Now, Lamoa is one of just three major foundational agreements that the U.S. and India need to get done. And as you mentioned, the negotiations have been taking place for over a decade. And the issues from the Indian side, as you correctly pointed out, have to do with autonomy, worries that India is maybe dragged into situations where it might be asked to support the United States on certain positions where it does not want to. Now, the key here is that, I mean, the big picture here is that in spite of the fact that we've seen an Indian defense establishment as well as an Indian prime minister and Narendra Modi were dedicated to improving U.S.-India relations, it's still very difficult to get some of these substantive agreements past the Indian bureaucracy. You'll recall in our last big conversation about U.S.-India relations on the podcast, we talked about how U.S.-India defense relations were under A.K. Anthony, and that was a much more restrictive environment. Now, under Manohar Parrikar, there definitely is a greater willingness on the Indian side to work with the United States, but despite that, there are still bureaucratic obstacles to strengthening that relationship. So that's the sort of interesting contradiction, sort of the strategic convergence on the one hand, but real problems in terms of getting these technological agreements done that would actually promote meaningful and substantive cooperation. And obviously, a big part of that is the Indian domestic debate. And I wanted to sort of ask you if you could go into that a little bit more about some of the arguments that we've been hearing from the Indian side, some more alarmist than others. And if you can go through that, that'd be great.
Yeah, I think that's really a big part of this whole debate. And it really is the story of, you know, how India has approached the United States after liberalization in the 1990s and certainly after its nuclear test and the initial period of sanctions in the late 90s as well. But really, you know, Lamoa and similar initiatives to get closer to the U.S. have been criticized from both the left and the right in India. The criticism from the right often have to do with, you know, the tried and tested Indian defense relationship with Russia. And you have commentators on this side like Bharat Karnad who've made the argument that, you know, signing Lamoa is essentially a kiss of death for the relationship that India has historically enjoyed with Russia. I mean, Russia and India, you know, with the Soviet Union, India signed a treaty of friendship in 1971. And since then, most of India's defense hardware procurement, India's historically been the largest defense importer in the world, has been of Russian or Soviet origin. So obviously things have changed in the past few years. The United States actually overtook Russia briefly to become India's top defense supplier, and that trend appears to be increasing right now. But certainly that's one of the criticisms on the right, that getting closer to the United States by signing these foundational agreements will just shut some doors. I mean, India's Akula-class Russian submarine lease, which is set to expire in 2022, could potentially not be renewed again, depriving India of an important capability. That's something that, you know, might come to pan out. We really haven't seen how this will affect Russian calculations. Obviously, I think those criticisms might be a little bit overblown, since Russia is always looking for defense customers, and it certainly knows how to do business with India. There's a long history there of Russian suppliers and Indian buyers simply being comfortable working together that I think will just keep that relationship going, even with these incremental approaches towards the United States. The second is the criticism from the left, which I alluded to. I mean, the criticism The criticism from the left is pretty straightforward. It's essentially that Lamoa is the first step to an alliance with the United States, which some in India regard as an imperial hegemon, you know, prone to overreach occasionally. And certainly the example cited here is the Iraq War, but also, you know, previous U.S. adventures and misadventures across Asia. And here there's really not much to be said. I mean, even if Lamoa weren't to be signed, I mean, there just tends to be a generic opposition to getting closer to Washington on this side of the debate. So it essentially just seems to be an extension of those reservations just coming on to defense cooperation. But like you said, you know, there are two other foundational agreements, and both of those are also important to moving this relationship forward. There's a SysMOA, which involves the United States supplying India with proprietary encrypted communications equipment and systems. And again, like Lamoa, you know, this type of cooperation has been going on. I mean, when the Malabar exercises happen, the bilateral naval exercises between India and the United States, India essentially taps into the U.S. Centric's communication system already. What SysMOA would do is simply make that a little bit easier and just generalize that for other exercises, including, you know, anti-piracy operations, humanitarian assistance operation. So really, these foundational agreements, what they're doing is they're just setting up the infrastructure for sustained cooperation between these two countries. And also, you know, I mean, late last year, the two countries renewed their 10-year defense cooperation framework, which really sets forth a path that really kind of rests on these foundational agreements getting concluded. So they're definitely important, I'd say. Do you want to talk very briefly about the DTTI, since that's a big part of this too?
Sure. I mean, I think as you correctly pointed out, I mean, all this is sort of leading to the broader question of the broader infrastructure of the U.S.-India defense relationship. And the DTTI is sort of the foundational element of that. And I guess the important thing to keep in mind about DTTI is that, you know, Ash Carter was personally involved in that. So that definitely has been sort of a pet project of his for a long time. And the sort of architecture of that, that you have now various working groups under which the U.S. and India are pursuing tangible cooperation on a number of areas, including, and we've talked about this before, aircraft carrier cooperation as well. So the DTTI is sort of the big mother initiative under which these sort of major cooperation areas rest. Now, as you correctly pointed out, I mean, it's important to emphasize a lot of cooperation between the U.S. and India in the defense side is already going on, in spite of the fact that we haven't seen these foundational agreements negotiated. On Lamoa, for example, as you pointed out, I mean, this tightens existing logistic sharing that's already happening. And Parikar and Carter, in their press conference, were very careful to state the fact that this, A, does not have to do with bases, contrary to some of the commentary that's coming out, but also this allows both sides to approve things on a case-by-case basis to the comfort of both sides. So if India did have a particular reservation on some count, it could just simply decide not to do something. Just like the United States could decide not to do something. This in no way forces either the United States or India to do anything in particular. So I guess that is sort of the most important thing to keep in mind. Now, going back to DTTI for a second, I mean, the interesting thing there is that even while we have these foundational agreements still remaining unsigned, and, you know, remember, we've gone through so many cycles of the fact that we've expected Lamoa to be signed. I mean, whenever we've had visits, we've said, okay, the Lamoa is going to be signed now, and then you have a joint statement coming out saying that we look forward to the future signing of Lamoa. On the other hand, there are many people who are very bullish about U.S.-India defense relations, and if you look at the DTTI, eventually what this lends itself to doing is, I mean, if you're very looking at the U.S.-India relationship very broadly and very ambitiously, eventually what you'd like to get to a point of doing is eventually defense trade and some of these other bolder initiatives. But as long as we don't have these foundational agreements approved, it's going to be very hard for, just to take one example, U.S. companies to want to have their goods travel to India when they don't have things like basic intellectual property rights protection, when there's no good relationship between the two bureaucracies. I think The way you put it in your piece is very apt, which is that, you know, it's almost like a lubricant, right, to grease the wheels of these bureaucracies. And I think that is a key point to emphasize here.
Just to add on the DTTI, I think, you know, going back to that idea of immense potential, but left unrealized, I think there's a potential for that to happen with the DTTI Pathfinder projects. Aircraft carrier cooperation in particular, I think, is interesting. Nuclear propulsion is one of those things that I think some people who watch this relationship are, and perhaps a little bit more optimistic, see nuclear propulsion as kind of like the big kahuna item for US-India defense cooperation. If India gets that, you know, it'd be the first Asian navy or the first non-Western navy actually to make that work in a carrier. And you know, it's interesting to see, like, recently we've just seen reports that China's third carrier might potentially have nuclear propulsion and might actually have a catapult launch system, which again, no Asian navy has to date. And that's another thing that India is considering. It's considering, General Atomics's EMALS launch system, which would work well with India's second indigenous aircraft carrier. So I think these are some things to watch. I mean, if you see these things getting concluded, I think that's a very positive sign for the US-India relationship more broadly. And, you know, honestly, going back to that critique about India's relationship with Russia, I mean, if these projects are getting completed, I think there's something to be said for a bright future just cooperating with the United States on technology. And there's also, you know, I don't want to get into this in too much detail right now, but there's a very interesting debate that sprung up in recent months in India on the possibility of flying F-16s and building them in India, which is, again, a big part of
Yes.
India's trouble getting foreign defense deals signed is India usually wants to produce things at home, particularly in Modi's government. The Make in India initiative is really important. So that's been a huge sticking point with France, for example, for the Rafales. So that'll certainly be something also to watch for as the US-India defense relationship moves forward. So let's talk a bit about the strategic and commercial dialogue now. You know, you were watching that as well in Delhi, Prashant. What were your impressions there between, you know, the talks between Kerry and Pritzker and their Indian counterparts?
Yeah, I think relative to the defense relationship, which really over the past few years, the both sides have been working really hard to improve in spite of the obstacles we've just been talking about. In terms of the strategic and commercial dialogue, this is still a very young mechanism. It's only in its second iteration. It's sort of a 2+2 format where you have the ministers in charge of foreign affairs and commerce meeting together. And if you look at the joint statement, it's very long and very diverse in terms of the areas. So you have security and strategic areas like cyber and terrorism. Then you have regional and global issues, peacekeeping, Security Council reform, South China Sea. And on the economic side, if you read through the statements carefully, including the one that was recently issued in New Delhi, there's a lot of breadth, but not a lot of depth. And in fact, some of the key areas, if you look at, for example, what it says about trade policy, it's very, very short. In fact, a little laughably short. And that attests to the fact that trade policy in the Indian context, because of, you know, well-known historical reasons that have to do with protectionism, et cetera, India hasn't been able to make a lot of headway in that area. India is not part of the TPP. It is part of the RCEP negotiations, but TPP is really the big initiative that the United States is introducing, and India is still in the process of trying to figure out some of its involvement in economic arrangements. I mean, there's been a big push recently, for example, with India and APEC, for example, right? And India being left out has been a sore point for New Delhi for a long time. So
And APEC's a
the
precondition for TPP, I should point out.
exactly, that's right. Yeah. So I would say overall, strategic and commercial dialogue, relative to the defense relationship, it's still early days, and haven't seen a lot of significant progress. A lot of, you know, small things on startups, small cities, science and technology, but no sort of two or three or four big things, primarily because of the obstacles in the Indian context domestically.
I guess one of the big takeaways, I guess, I found interesting was India's introduction of the first long-term permanent residency arrangement for non-ethnic Indians, which is a it's a pretty I think that's a pretty significant carrot for foreign direct investors. It's not specifically designed for U.S. investors per se, but it's certainly, you know, it was announced right as Kerry and Pritzker were about to leave New Delhi. So I think there's a bit of symbolism there. And India, I think, voiced its concerns to the United States on the costs for professional visas as well. So I think there's you know, some movement there. That's also a big initiative of the Modi government. But, you know, talking about the strategic side of this, Prashant, I think what's also been interesting and will be worth watching going forward on the geopolitical front is the relationship between Washington and Islamabad. And India has always been a little bit uncomfortable with that arrangement. But lately there are signs, I think, that, you know, Washington and Islamabad are starting to grow apart in some ways. I mean, that's been really ongoing since 2011 after the Osama bin Laden raid. But, you know, just recently we saw that U.S. government data shows that this will be the first year since 2007, sorry, that U.S. aid to Pakistan will drop below $1 billion. And I think more broadly, I mean, as long as that process continues and India starts to feel that it can rely on Washington as a full-on bilateral partner, I mean, India is very sensitive to being perceived as hyphenated with Pakistan. So as long as it sees the United States pursuing its relationship with New Delhi completely on its own regard, apart from Pakistan, I think that's a positive sign. So that would just be something to watch for going forward.
Yeah, definitely agree. And I think important in this whole context is the fact that the Obama administration, particularly in recent years, has made a deliberate effort to de-hyphenate India in terms of Pakistan, because that's a very sore point for New Delhi. And I know many of us who watch Asia closely understand that if Hillary Clinton is elected, there might be a lot more continuity in terms of Obama's foreign policy towards the Asia Pacific relative to Donald Trump, say. But it's important to keep in mind that all these advances in the U.S.-India relationship, including the signing of LAMO, which is a key foundational agreement, is happening as the Obama administration winds down its second term. So there is sort of a sense, I think, in both capitals of the need to sort of project this idea that the U.S.-India relationship is on a strong footing as the Obama administration concludes and leaves office.
Right. Well, I think we can leave it there for now, and this will certainly be something we come back to. I think there's some possibility that Modi and Obama will meet on the sidelines of the G20 that's coming up, and also possibly in New York at the General Assembly. Well, Prashant, thanks for joining me today.
Good to be with you.
Yeah, and we'll be back next week with more. We might follow up on the outcome of the summit tree. Modi is actually on his way to Vietnam, which was something we couldn't get to on this episode, but we'll definitely be back to talk about India's involvement in Southeast Asia more broadly. So please do leave us a review if you haven't already on iTunes, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. Thanks for listening.